right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Crypto 101 Podcast. I'm Bryce, as always, joined by my good buddy, my notorious compadre, Brendan Veman. Mr. Brendan, how are you doing, my man?
I am doing fantastic. So many good things going on. Very excited to be able to do this episode today because, man, we got another very special guest.
Absolutely. What I'm really excited about is this person's market acumen, his investing acumen. We've got the founding partner of Stratos, which is an incredible investment firm in the crypto space. This is Renick Paley. Renick, bro, thanks for joining us. How are you feeling today?
Feeling pretty good. Nice to start off a new quarter. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah, quarter one in the books, quarter two in the books. We're recording this here kind of at the start of Q3. How did things fare for you in Q2? Did things go well? Were things flat? Were things bad?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what part of the portfolio and which funds you're talking about for us, which I think probably is similar to pretty much everyone else in the crypto space. Basically, if you didn't own a huge position in Bitcoin, maybe ETH, maybe Solana, depending on what your goals are, Q2 was kind of an unfortunate month or quarter. Mm-hmm. June obviously was probably the worst of it. You know, alts didn't fare well. I have some views as to why that was the case and where we might be going. But, you know, it just reminds you of what crypto is all about. You know, Q1 was awesome. Everyone was euphoric. End of March felt amazing. You know, I remember saying to my team, Q1 2024 is the best quarter that Stratos has ever had, just in terms of total volume of gains and profits, which is probably not dissimilar to a lot of the other investment firms in crypto. And, you know, unfortunately, Q2, not as good. But that's just the way it is in the space. So,
yeah, Renick, I'm curious if there was any kind of catalyst that you saw on your end that would make maybe some of these larger market cap cryptos that you mentioned, like Bitcoin and Ethereum and Solana, outperform most of the mainstream altcoin market.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, because I think what we would say on the surface is, well, what happened coming basically from the end of Q1 through Q2, one of the big changes in the markets from a macro perspective was market participants lowering their expectations of rate cuts in 2024. Basically, coming into the year, there was as high as an expectation of 7 rate cuts, and that's basically been walked down to between 1 and 2, which is a pretty significant difference. Now, looking at the S&P 500, NASDAQ, and the majors, you know, they didn't really react to that in the way that you would have thought, in the sense that, you know, stocks are continuing to make all-time highs. Obviously, that's really helped by the Magnificent Seven and NVIDIA. A very small cohort of the stocks are really driving the market. And it's kind of the same thing for crypto. The majors are still performing fairly well, all things considered, given the delta in rate cut expectations. So then the question is, well, what's going on with alts? You know, the alts market, you kind of have to disaggregate into different subsectors. And the sectors that have gotten hit the hardest are those that basically have some overhang for significant token unlocks throughout the end of 2024 to 2025. If you look at memes, if you look at some of the older coins, they're actually doing better. The older coins, you know, it's pretty mixed. But, you know, I think by and large, a big component of this is, you know, the majors, a lot of market participants have rotated into majors, looking at kind of Q1 as being like a short-term interim peak, rotating into majors for safety or stables, and then coming out of alts. And so the alts flows have really been negative as a result. So I think it's a combination of all these things. You know, if you look at the overall sentiment on crypto Twitter, it's super negative. Most market participants do not have significant weightings in the majors because they're looking for higher returns in alts. So they're not happy about that. And the overall vibe when it comes to, you know, venture-backed, high FTV, low float tokens is pretty negative as well. I have some views on that. I think it's eventually going to turn around, but I think that's a high-level recap of what's going on and why.
Yeah, that's super fascinating. There's a lot that we could really drill into on that. But before we go too deep into some of the details, let's get the audience acquainted with Stratos. You guys, you know, manage around $500 million in crypto assets across a variety of strategies. Tell us a little bit about your founding and sort of, you know, what you guys bring to the table.
Yeah, so I founded Stratos in 2016. I started personally investing in crypto in 2016. We launched our first crypto-focused venture fund in late 2020. So we have now two crypto-focused venture funds, one that's technically a 2021 vintage, another that's a 22 vintage, and we also have a liquid crypto fund that invests in the majors as well as alts. And you know, the reason why I wanted to start Stratos and get into crypto was I discovered Ethereum in 2015. Before that, I was familiar with Bitcoin. At the time, I was interested in it, but didn't fully wrap my head around why Bitcoin is such a significant technological innovation. But it was really Ethereum and the ability to create smart contracts and really disintermediate a lot of the existing financial system that really captured my attention. At the time, I was working at a hedge fund in New York, and I saw the potential and felt that crypto represented probably the most disruptive tech that I had come across at that point. And so I started investing in crypto. I was a seed investor in Compound Finance. I had kind of the thought that DeFi could exist before it was being called DeFi. When I made the investment in Compound, it was pre-DeFi. So, I think a lot of what I was hoping to see happen has happened. A lot of it hasn't happened yet. But by and large, it's been a really fun ride to be in crypto, obviously. Some great days and some not so great days, but overall, it's been great to be involved in the industry.
Oh, I was just going to say, I love the fact that you were in DeFi before it was even called DeFi. And for anybody who was kind of like, you know, watching at home, Compound was really the inventor of what we now know as liquidity mining or yield farming. This was a huge innovation in crypto where you could kind of use a platform and then also get compensated for the platform or basically in the platform's tokens or like pseudo equity, if you want to call it that. And so it was this huge innovation that everybody started doing no matter kind of what platform you were. And if you didn't do it, then you kind of, you know, lost out to the platforms that did do it because the amount of growth and user acquisition that this liquidity mining offered was unparalleled. And so you probably saw that and you're like, oh, this is a cool innovation. Let's invest in it. But then you also followed up with a lot of the things that we, envisioned have not, you know, come to market yet. And so that there's still a story to be told with this DeFi innovation. And I'm just curious a little bit about sort of what are those things that you still envision that are innovative in DeFi that are yet to fully, you know, take hold in the market?
Yeah, I mean, I would say beyond DeFi, it's things like SocialFi, things like Uber on chain, putting, you name it, all kinds of applications on chain. And I think, you know, there was a time period, particularly in like the ICO boom, where everyone was really excited about putting every Web2 thing on chain. And I think what we've learned as an industry since then is some things make sense to be on chain and some things don't. And also some of the skepticism around what things should be on chain that aren't yet or haven't worked yet, actually to some degree are a byproduct of just where the infrastructure is today and where it needs to be for those things to actually make sense at scale.
Yeah, I'm curious, you know, you mentioned Compound. Are there any other ones that stand out to you? You know, just going through and kind of looking at your history. I mean, you have Fuel, you have Goldfinch, you have Demo, you have Aleph, you have a lot of these projects that listeners are probably familiar with. Does one of those stand out above the rest to you? Maybe it just has like a really cool story. Maybe one was just a little bit more successful. Curious to, yeah, just get your thoughts.
The fortunate thing about being an early stage venture investor is that each one of the investments ends up becoming its own like interesting story and like journey that you take with a team. So I have a lot to say about all of these. I'm just thinking about, you know, which ones to summarize. One of the things that I think is really exciting about early stage investing in crypto, especially, is you can kind of look at where the space is at the moment, you know, in real time, and say to yourself, where do I think it's going based on my knowledge of the projects that are in process that are going to launch soon? What is going to become possible in the next few years that maybe isn't today? And therefore, what opportunity set does that open up that we can invest in? And so, for example, I would look at RWAs. So two investments that we made in RWAs, one is Goldfinch, another one is Bakkt Finance. We made those investments, and I was actually a founding advisor at Goldfinch. We got involved in those projects before RWAs was a thing. It's kind of like, you know, what I was saying about DeFi. No one was calling them real world assets. It wasn't really a hot narrative. We were just looking at the world and saying, well, if you can tokenize things, like, why don't you start tokenizing things that are off chain? And especially being able to bring some real world yield on chain. We felt that that was really exciting because going back to Compound, looking at liquidity mining, we thought it was a really interesting innovation. But at the time we made the investments in the RWA projects, we had kind of seen the dark side of liquidity mining, which is essentially that it's highly dilutive to your token and it ends up driving the token price down. So it's kind of a double-edged sword. And the issue with a lot of the yield in DeFi, especially during DeFi summer, was it was this kind of like Quanzynomics yield that wasn't actually backed by any real cash flow that made it sustainable. And so the insight was, why don't you go grab some of that real world activity off chain and bring it on chain? And so that's partially the things that inspired those investments at the time.
And it's crazy how fast, like, that sector specifically has just started to sprout. Because I feel like, you know, in the previous market cycles, we never really talked about this stuff. And you're right, you know, now it finally has a name so we can at least identify the sector, but it still feels so young. And here's TradFi, right, you know, coming in. BlackRock's now building the Biddle Fund, which is targeting a lot of this stuff. And there's so much potential for it. But it seems like the, you know, the reoccurring narrative that I'm noticing is that you're looking for sectors that can have huge market impact that aren't overly saturated yet. You know, you talk about finding them before they're even labeled as a sector, you know, before we even have a kind of a nickname for them here in the crypto space. But that seems to kind of be the key, is like, look at where there's not, you know, loads of competition, right? You know, we see some products, I think the easy kind of one to beat up on is like the layer one argument of like, we constantly see a million layer ones that are a little bit faster and they're a little bit cheaper and everyone keeps making them. But it seems like the more interesting kind of, you know, maybe idea to look for is something that's a little bit more innovative, something that can, you know, have that real world impact and maybe steal away market share from a sector that crypto hasn't already kind of dipped its toes in.
And to actually find the consumers, right? Find the people that are going to use it, which I think is kind of one of the things you mentioned, Renick, like the things that are yet to be built are the quote unquote Ubers or, you know, DoorDashes of crypto that make these, you know, peer-to-peer marketplaces that are just as easy to use as Apple Pay or something like that, which I think is going to happen, I hope.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, there are two opposing arguments that we see for why some of these things should come on chain and why they shouldn't. One is, well, if you don't need a distributed ledger with extremely high levels of security and decentralization, then it doesn't need to use a blockchain. That's one argument. I think that's a valid argument, and it kind of depends on what you're optimizing for with that particular product. The other argument is, well, yes, you may not need the actual user data to have that level of decentralization, but if you want to actually leverage the crypto payments rails, which many applications, almost every application has some payment component in it, it makes sense for it to touch blockchains or be on chain in some way. So we're kind of more in the latter camp. We're more optimistic about what can eventually be on chain. But I think to comment on what you said about innovation, I think that there, if you look at technology historically, there are cycles where you have an infrastructure installation phase and an application phase. And these things can oftentimes happen in parallel, or they happen in cycles. And you can go back all the way to the railroads to that. And, you know, I think looking at what happened with the railroads versus crypto is actually a really, seems odd, but actually a really interesting historical lesson to look at and say, what are the similarities? Because there are quite a few. And what I mean by that is, you know, if you look at railroads, it was this massive technological boom that basically connected the entire United States at a time where you couldn't get around, basically. So it was a step function change versus what existed at the time. But there was an overabundance of railroads built at one time. And then a lot of those railroads ended up getting used eventually by the amount of objects and people that needed to be transported on those railroads. And, you know, some of them failed because there wasn't enough demand, or they were built between cities that didn't actually have that level of demand to sustain them. But ultimately, over time, the amount of rail traffic that was created as a response to the infrastructure that had been built actually far surpassed what people had originally anticipated. And so you could say the same thing about broadband, and, you know, internet connections. And, you know, I think the same thing will eventually happen with blockchains. Now, that isn't to say that every random L1 should exist or that every random L2 should exist, but at the same time, saying that today is not a good time to continue investing in infrastructure, I don't necessarily agree with, because it's that underlying infrastructure that actually opens up the design space for new apps. And if you look at where we are today versus even where we were last cycle, you know, the speed and low cost possibilities today are vastly greater than they were last cycle. And so in order for some of these more consumer facing apps to make sense, you have to have the infrastructure and the UX there to make it very easy, very cheap, and seamless for users to engage with. And I think we're just getting to that point. And I'm really excited about what kind of app layer things we're going to start to see.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. And, you know, we've had people on the show who've come from all different sorts of, camps, if you will. We've had the people from the Bitcoin maximalist camp who say, you know, all of the future of crypto and all the future of finance, it's all going to end up being anchored on Bitcoin in some way, shape, or form. We've had Ethereum maxis saying, you know, it's going to be layer twos and all this kind of stuff that's going to come out, but it's all going to settle on Ethereum. And then we've had kind of the third layer of person who's maybe the multi-chain maximalist, if you will. Hey, there's going to be lots of settlement layers. There's going to be lots of networks. There's going to be lots of things, and they're all going to be able to intercommunicate, just like, you know, if you go on Chrome browser, you could kind of get anywhere on the web, and it doesn't matter what the web page is scripted in or yada, yada, yada. It's just a seamless experience. Where do you kind of fall on that trichotomy, if you will?
Yeah, good term. I personally, what I'll say first is I love maxis. I think it's a really interesting like aspect of this space that people see the chain that they're most committed to and see the possibilities for it and want it to win or take over the whole space. I think it's great that these crypto networks are able to produce that level of emotion out of people and commitment. I think that is kind of like goes to show like how powerful these crypto economics can be. In terms of my view and our view, we're open-minded to all of the possibilities. I think it's very hard to say which way things are going to play out because it's still very early in the life cycle of this technology. However, I'm pretty sure that it's going to be a multi-chain world. And the reason why I'm pretty sure about that is, one, we already have a ton of chains, whether you count all the L2s as well or not, but many different execution layers, if you want to think about it that way. And unless we have a mass extinction, we're going to always have lots of execution layers. And even if we were to have an extinction event, people, for some reason, still want to keep creating execution layers. And the reason for that is there's a very strong economic incentive to control your own execution layer. The crypto market values execution layers most highly. Now, arguably, it's monetary premium for L1s, but the point is still, this subset of crypto infrastructure is what is most highly valued by the market, almost without exception. And so that economic incentive will create the incentive for people to continue doing that. And I also think there's a cultural aspect to it. You know, new chains get created, people become bag holders, they then become maxis, and you get this, you know, community subset that just sticks around that chain and wants it to continue to exist. And because of their fervent belief, it continues to exist. You know, look at the Link Marines, or, you know, the folks on Cardano. You know, you can go down the list of projects that I think people who are interested in the cutting edge of the tech would kind of say, yeah, I don't know what place this has anymore, but still there's a large enough community of holders that believe it's going to be the thing and continue to support it.
You know, I like that you have this kind of like agnostic, almost unbiased approach where you're saying, hey, we're going to look at like the two-part series here. We're going to look at what infrastructure gets built, you know, how it gets built, and then we'll look at the applicational side afterwards. And I think that that's smart because it gives you time to react and you're not necessarily saying, hey, we're going to make these long shots. We're going to say, hey, we're going to analyze the market. We're going to see what's working. We're going to see where market sentiment is, and then we can make those plays. And you've done that, right? You've analyzed once infrastructure was in place for DeFi, you then made your DeFi play. Once infrastructure was in place for RWAs, you made your RWA plays. And I think that that's a really good outlook to have on the market from an investment perspective. You don't have to be the person saying, hey, like this, you don't have to make the moves before they happen, right? You can kind of wait for that foundation. And so I really like that, but I'm also curious, you know, what do you think some of the biggest barriers to the mass adoption of maybe RWAs, but I guess more so even just blockchain as a whole are? Like, what do you think some of those like big barriers that we have left are?
So just speaking about crypto as a whole, I think there are two angles of adoption. There is sort of like the financial adoption of crypto, which, you know, we can start to see beginning with the ETFs, but eventually will be TradFi hedge funds owning alts, or even, you know, the average person in their retirement account owning alts. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a crazy thing, but eventually I see that happening. And then on the other side, you have the average consumer using a crypto application on a day-to-day basis. So on the TradFi investing side, owning alts, the biggest barrier there, in my opinion, is regulatory clarity. And I'm hoping we're going to get that soon. I think things are just starting to turn around in the US, yeah, where we could actually get some kind of framework where you can take the value that's created by an application and pass it on to the token holders. In my opinion, that is the biggest thing that is keeping a sophisticated traditional finance investor from owning crypto.
Because 100%.
They have the alternative. They have the alternative to go own something on the NASDAQ or S&P 500, where they can say, look, this company is generating $1 billion of earnings per year. The stock is trading at $30 billion market cap. I can analyze what the earnings growth is going to be and how they're going to return that $1 billion a year back to me as a shareholder. And so that means that there's always a relationship between the company's performance and the price of the stock. And so someone who is sitting there on a spreadsheet trying to figure that out has the comfort knowing, look, worst case scenario, if the stock price drops below a certain level, the company is going to use that $1 billion that they make every year to buy back the stock. And they're going to bail me out, basically. It's like the Fed printing money.
Hey, it's Sean Nelson, founder and CEO of Lovesac and host of the Let Me Save You 25 Years podcast. Want to skip the trial and error so you can head straight to success? Join me and incredible guests like Olympic legend Shaun White and NFL superstar Rob Gronkowski as we share the lessons and mistakes that shaped our journeys. Ready to save yourself 25 years? Tune in on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Let Me Save You 25 Years with Shaun Nelson. Listen now.
With crypto, you could go buy a token that's completely unlinked to what's actually happening on that protocol, because a lot of these protocol communities are concerned about passing that value back to the token holder. So
so that they don't kind of trip the securities laws, basically.
Yeah, they don't know what they can and can't do. So, you know, they err on the side of caution and do nothing. There are some protocols, some of the best performing tokens over the long term have actually been the ones that do send value back to the holders. And I think they've just chosen to take that risk, but the vast majority of them don't. You know, look at Uniswap, for example. They're getting sued now. And I think when you compare crypto assets to TradFi stocks, once they actually start to look more similar, TradFi investors will get comfortable. And that's over $100 trillion asset class. So you can imagine what those flows can start to look like. Because when you look at a lot of these DeFi protocols, for example, these are incredible businesses. Like when you look at the fundamentals of a DeFi protocol like Compound or Uniswap, for example, the level of revenue that they're able to generate for a very small amount of cost is incredible. The margins on these businesses are better than almost anything you would see in the NASDAQ, which you know is quite remarkable. The other thing is they pass off a lot of the costs, the operating costs to their customers because they make the users pay gas fees. I think eventually that will be internalized just in the same way. Like when you use Netflix, you don't also pay server fees. You just pay a one-time, you know, monthly fee. And so I think eventually, you know, DeFi dApps and everything else on chain will go that way. It's already starting to go that way with gasless transactions and things. But anyway, that's kind of my view of like why that's important for the financial adoption of crypto. Well, I'll stop there before I move on to the consumer side.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we should kind of dive into that a little bit more. It's fascinating because is this something that we could see changing with some of the regulations, whether it's the FIT 21 bill or whether it's, you know, some regulatory sandbox, you know, when that sort of revenue generation, that profit, all that could, you know, start getting shared back with token holders and it you know, makes it a crypto security. Are we going to have that sort of path to regulation? Do you foresee that?
I think it's possible. It kind of depends on how the presidential election plays out. You know, someone tweeted, I think, that it's possible Hester Pierce could end up becoming the SEC chair. That would be like the crypto dream scenario. I've read a lot of what she's one of the, I guess, associate chairs or I can't remember her title, but she's very senior at the SEC. And in a lot of cases, she's been presenting sort of counter arguments for a lot of the anti-crypto SEC regulation and actually has proposed a lot of really forward thinking ideas around how crypto can both be regulated, but also not stifled by that. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that she proposed is this idea of like a sandbox framework where basically you have a certain amount of time once the token has been issued to decentralize. And there's a number of prongs on the test for what decentralization is. And if you do that within those number of years, then, you know, there's a no action kind of assumption, which I think is a huge step forward from where we are today and makes things a lot more workable. I mean, I remember when I was working with Goldfinch, just the hoops we had to jump through just to try and like figure out whether a token could be launched and, you know, what that meant from a regulatory standpoint and setting up various entities offshore to do so. It was just a huge time suck and not productive. And so I hope that will change soon.
Yeah, you know, earlier you mentioned the idea that like as we move forward, getting normal retail investors and I guess even institutional investors into altcoins is going to be something that probably happens, right? I'm curious, you know, most recently we saw first the Bitcoin ETF, then the Ethereum ETF get approved, but it hasn't begun trading. Now, recently, we've seen two different Solana ETF applications. So I guess I'm curious, you know, do you think that a lot of these people who are looking to get crypto in their retirement accounts, you know, those traditional altcoins in their retirement accounts, do you think that that's going to come through ETFs and that we're going to have all these different cryptocurrency ETFs out there and that's going to be their like investment vertical? Or do you think that they're actually going to be going through more like traditional exchanges and actually own, like maybe even decentralized ways? But like basically the question that I'm asking is like, do you think people are going to go and buy their own crypto? Or do you think that we're just going to have a bunch of these ETFs floating around and that's going to be their primary investment vertical?
I think both. I think people are going to continue to create ETFs as long as there's a business opportunity to do it. I think the two things are going to converge over time where, you know, on the one hand, you have average folks, retirement accounts, financial advisors saying, hey, I want to own the top five crypto assets. You know, and maybe that looks like they go out and they buy Bitcoin, ETH, Sol, Doge, Link, whatever. Those top five crypto ETFs for their 5% allocation to crypto, and they're done. But on the other hand, you're going to have more sophisticated investors like New York hedge funds. You know, the day that you can look at a blue chip DeFi protocol that is basically generating a 10% earnings yield or a 10% dividend yield or buying back 10% of the token float every year, and a sophisticated hedge fund can look at that and say, wait a minute, I can go generate triple the earnings yield that I can generate. I can generate this in crypto versus, you know, triple what I could generate buying NASDAQ stocks. They're going to start buying it, and they're going to buy it any way that they can, as long as they feel good about the sustainability of those profits, which, you know, is just a function of crypto becoming more mature and having a longer track record and just an overall bigger market. And but they're going to find a way to own it and benefit from those returns anyway, whether, you know, there are ETFs for every asset, which I think is possible, but less likely. I think it's more likely that exchanges like Coinbase and Binance become more and more sophisticated, that it almost feels like having a CME futures exchange account or having a, you know, an account with a prime broker that can trade on the NYSE or, you know, NASDAQ, et cetera.
And another thing that I think could be really cool is seeing crypto-based indices become more popular, where people can look at the market like they would something like the S&P 500, and then they can get exposure to a bunch of different things without having to get overexposed to one altcoin. Because I think that's what a lot of people get nervous about. They're like, oh, did I pick the right coin? These things are so volatile. And I know that they exist. You know, Bryce, you know, we've talked to them a few times about the different indices that are out there, but they're still not largely popular in the sense that we don't see traditional financial institutions dive in too deep into them. But I think that the more ETFs that we get, the more regulation that we have in place, the more clear this stuff is, we're going to start seeing that become a reality. And I think that that's going to be a really good thing for the overall growth of the entire crypto space.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think there's two reasons why we don't really have that yet. I think the first reason is Bitcoin has outperformed almost everything over a long enough time horizon that people say, why bother with anything else? And that's kind of a good question. I think some of the things we talked about a minute ago with regulation are going to change that. And then the other thing is, it's actually really hard to build an index of crypto. Now, you can create an index that just tracks the actual tokens, but creating like an ETF that has like the top 30 tokens in it or the top 400 tokens in it is really hard just from a portfolio management perspective, because the long tail of assets has such little liquidity in crypto. You know, the, between asset number 101 to asset number 400 in terms of total market cap is, you know, the liquidity gets so small that you couldn't have more than 10, 20, $30 million in that ETF product. So there's also just a scalability and portfolio management problem there that, again, as crypto overall gets larger and exceeds $10 trillion, we're going to see that get a lot easier to do, and those things will exist. And actually, we have a hedge fund, the liquid fund at Stratos that we run is actually benchmarked against the S&P crypto benchmark, which is actually the top 400 tokens. And we did that intentionally for the reasons that you mentioned. People over the long term are going to be interested in owning crypto as a market overall, not just Bitcoin and ETH or whatever, you know, subset of alts they hold today.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think there's definitely going to be a big evolution on that institutional side. And I think that'll bode well for sort of those tokens that have the fundamentals backing them. But empirically, what we've seen in the recent, let's just call it two or three quarters, meme coins and sort of coins that tout their lack of fundamentals have been performing best. And I think it's certainly, like you said, it's like, you know, the regulations aren't there yet to enable all this value passed back to the token holders. So there's a lot of just future anticipation maybe that they will eventually. Whereas meme coins say we're never going to have that. This is just a, you know, I don't know. It's just a community. And if you like it, you buy in. If you stop liking it, you sell out. And so it just brings in such an interesting question to the mind of any investor. Because I think most people, you know, they get into markets and they think, if I'm not going to hold something for 10 years, I'm not going to hold it for 10 minutes. You know, the classic sort of value school of investing, but then here's a meme coin. And it doesn't have sort of the qualities that I'd look for something in 10 years. So why am I going to hold it? But those do the best. And so how do you kind of square that in your mind as an investor? Like, you know, probably you like to look at the fundamentals and approach it from a value perspective, but also, you know, I know that you guys have done meme coin investing and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think the first, you know, important rule is to know the game that you're playing. The game of meme coins is completely different than the fundamentals, you know, value-based approach. In fact, the beauty of meme coins is the fact that they have no fundamentals. They have no cash flows. They never purport themselves to have either of those things. The point is, which of these can get the most attention, which can create the communities behind them. And, you know, the benefit is, if you're right, there's uncapped upside. A token can be worth 300 million market cap. It can be worth 3 billion. It could be worth 30 billion. And nothing about it has to change other than more people are buying it. So that creates a lot of risk, but also a lot of opportunity. And the fact that these also have no token unlock overhangs has really attracted a lot of people, especially, you know, the non-professional investors who, you know, are the majority of the crypto market, the liquid crypto market today, into these tokens versus the things that have been venture-backed that have token unlocks. Now, I do think that the venture-backed things will recover and do well once people get over the token unlock issue. And, you know, maybe the market has to digest even more red days as more of these tokens unlock. But, you know, venture-backed projects and real tech in the space isn't going anywhere. But on the meme side, you know, I can see this continuing to be really popular and actually not going away. I think memes are only going to get bigger. I think they're going to change their form. I think, you know, some of these like celebrity memes, this is a format that I think has a lot of staying power. What we're seeing today are just like the early test runs of it. And yeah, there's a lot of bad things about it, but it's going to be a great thing when, you know, Instagram users with 50 million followers have some crypto aspect, some crypto token, maybe not that they're shilling or that they're trying to rug people with, ideally not, but something that enables them to engage with their user base and actually bring that user base on chain.
Yeah, no, it's one of those things that it's just like, I think that the best traders are probably going to be able to time that pivot well, where kind of like what you mentioned, even with like the NASDAQ, you look at the earnings potential on some of those stocks versus the earnings potential on something like MakerDAO. And it's like, well, you know, if MakerDAO had the same sort of, you know, discounted cash flow or whatever analysis, and it was trading on the stock exchange, a lot of smart hedge funds would probably be buying that thing up, you know, relative to the NASDAQ, just because of its juice that it has and its, you know, earnings relative to its kind of valuation and its market cap. Mm-hmm. And so I could see that happening, but when do you think that pivot point will come where it's like you and rest of the smart money is going to start pivoting from their meme coins and from sort of that more speculative side to like, all right, now's the time where the market's mature and it's time to kind of invest in fundamentals only. Because, you know, most, you know, in sort of quote unquote, you know, traditional markets, there's no place for things that don't have value. They kind of just get shorted to zero. But I don't know, maybe there is a place for meme coins and there's a new valuation kit on the block or something.
Look, I mean, there are plenty of meme stocks too. One could argue that Nvidia and Tesla are both meme stocks. Right, they don't trade at a reasonable multiple to earnings. So I think meme tokens are here to stay regardless. It's such a fun place. Let's just call it what it is. It's basically a casino, except for it generally has a positive expected value overall as an asset class. It's got people's attention. It feeds into people's dopamine addictions. It's not going away. But in terms of like the rotation into, you know, fundamentals backed tokens, I think it's possible we could see that later this year, depending on how the presidential election goes, because people are going to kind of see the progression that I mentioned, and they're going to front run it. On the other hand, it could take a couple of years. I think it's really hard to nail that, but I think it's coming. The other thing I would say, though, is if you look at a lot of these projects like MakerDAO, for example, I think it's an incredible project with, you know, great staying power. I would love to get constructive on owning it, but I think that the valuation today is fairly high relative to what you would call like their sustainable earnings. And so I think that's true for a lot of DeFi protocols. And so eventually what will happen is either they'll have to find a way to make more money to justify their valuations, or their market caps will have to come down. And once that happens, then they'll be in the sweet spot for long-term holders.
Love that. It's super fascinating how you look at different sort of valuation points where, hey, you know, this is where I'm going to get in. This is where I think it's undervalued. This is where I think it's overvalued, and being able to express that in the markets. Whereas most people just, they don't even, you know, really think about valuation. They just kind of look at price. Oh, is it in some technical pattern? Is there some moving average crossover? Is there some volume anomaly? But you're really looking at things, you know, at least on the fundamental, on the sort of that side of the book, if you will, at those valuation ratios and stuff. Which a lot of people in crypto, you know, don't pay attention to. So there's a lot more that we could go into there. But before we let you go, we just want to kind of get your thoughts on just the future potential of this market cycle, particularly. You know, crypto's kind of moved historically in this 4-year cycle. Do you think that's going to happen again? Do you think we're kind of in that sweet spot post-halving? Or do you think that with the introduction of institutional capital, that 4-year cycle actually doesn't really exist anymore?
Yeah. So what I would say about that is we only have a couple of data points of historical 4-year cycles. So I don't think it's a law of physics. That being said, there's no reason to believe that we're not going to have a 4-year cycle, in my opinion. There are lots of things that happen every month in the market that people create narratives around and psyop the rest of crypto Twitter around why this isn't going to be a 4-year cycle. We're not going to have an alt cycle. We're going to have a left adjusted cycle where we peak in 2024. You know, we already topped in March of 2024. You know, people love to create narratives. You know, part of crypto Twitter and crypto overall is just about gaining people's attention. So coming up with new ideas as to why this is different, people are going to keep doing. If you look at past cycles, people were doing that the whole way through, both, you know, the 2021 cycle and 2017. So I think, again, there's no reason to believe we're not going to have it. There are plenty of good arguments that we can make as to why we won't have a 4-year cycle. But until proven otherwise, our expectation is that, yeah, things are going to peak late 2025 and it's going to play out like before. And that's kind of our view, and we're sticking to it until proven otherwise. So we'll see how things play out.
Yeah. And, you know, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but do you think that we're going to see a traditional altcoin season? Because that seems to be the topic where there's a lot of debate right now of people arguing whether it's going to be Bitcoin and Ethereum and large caps continuing to dominate the market in terms of performance and looking at like risk versus reward, or if there is going to be this switch and this pivot to where traditional altcoins come back in and they have the alt season that we have historically seen.
I'm fairly confident that we're going to see some form of an alt season. It may look different than the alt season from 2021. You know, one should expect that it would be different because, in my opinion, the only true alt season we've ever had was 2021. Prior to that, it was more of like the ICO boom, and it was a completely different thing. So I think we're going to have one. It's going to look different. Is it going to be dominated by memes? Possibly. Are the high FTV, low float VC tokens going to come back? I think so. But what's really going to drive it, I think, is TBD. But are we going to have a cycle where, you know, alts basically just slow bleed across the board, and the only things that perform are Bitcoin, ETH, and Sol? I mean, you know, it's not a 0% probability. I think it's fairly low, because then I think the question we have to ask is, where does crypto go after that? Mm-hmm. Is there going to be any incentive to build more stuff and launch new projects if basically alts seem like they're dead? And yeah, maybe that does happen and people finally kind of come to Jesus and say, these projects need to have some real cash flow. They need to be, you know, like a more traditional centralized company. And in that case, you know, so be it. I think it's for the best for the industry as well. And, you know, everyone will learn from that experience and move on. So, and build things that will actually be bought and not slow bleed as the tokens are issued. So overall, I'm optimistic on the space and what we're going to see this cycle.
And I think it's hard to have the success of those large cap layer ones without the infrastructure and the projects that are built on them doing well. Right. So that also to me says that there almost has to be an altcoin season, because in order for those layer one large caps to be doing well, one of the biggest measures of success is that the projects that are built on top of them are also doing well. So right. I think that's another important thing to kind of look at as well.
Yeah, there's huge reflexivity on every L1. You know, there's a wealth effect when ETH and SOL go up in dollar terms, then the participants on those chains are more wealthy. They do more trading, they become more degen. That drives trading fees on DeFi, which then drives those tokens, and you know, the whole system kind of feeds off of itself. So I agree.
Awesome. Well, hey, Renick, we've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation with you here today on the Crypto 101 podcast. Thank you so much for coming on. And where can people kind of follow along with you and Stratos on your guys' journey?
Yeah, you can check out our blog. It's on our website, stratos.xyz. We post a lot of our more in-depth research content there. And you can follow me on Twitter at Renick Paley. One word.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Renick. And thank you to everybody at home listening. Come back same time, same place next week. We'll have some more great guests for you.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/insightful. That's oracle.com/insightful. oracle.com/insightful.
People are driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. The hiring process can be slow and overwhelming. Simplify hiring with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. That's Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Terms and conditions apply.